This is Ozarks at Large. After scheduling an interview with an epidemiologist at Stanford University, Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek posted a question to her Facebook friends. What do you want to know about COVID-19? That's the basis for Zuzana's conversation with Assistant Professor of Biology Aaron Mordecai. They spoke last week. Here's part one of their conversation. Part two airs on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
Let's start with a real basic question. When we talk about epidemiology, which is a word I've gotten a lot better at saying lately, what does that entail? What are you looking at when we talk about this virus specifically?
I think in the context of COVID, epidemiology means thinking about who's getting infected at a most fundamental level. So how many people are infected, which subsets of the population are infected, and what types of disease those people are experiencing, which can range anywhere from no disease whatsoever. They feel 100% perfectly fine to something very mild to something, you know, maybe very unpleasant but manageable at home, all the way, of course, up to severe symptoms that require hospitalization and could even cause death, including things like organ failure and inability to breathe.
Our governor, Asa Hutchinson, gives a lot of numbers during his briefing. There's active cases, cumulative cases, positivity rate. So what numbers should we be paying attention to get an idea of whether the situation is getting better or whether it's getting worse?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the numbers have been one of the most challenging parts of this epidemic is that unlike some previous, you know, flu season, for example, usually the problem during flu season is not the lack of testing. So we don't know actually how many people have the flu. The problem is just the flu circulating. Whereas in this pandemic, we're experiencing this double problem of increasing numbers of cases of COVID disease, but also an inability to really know how much COVID is out there because we haven't had reliable access to testing and we haven't had sufficient access to testing. I know you were telling me just before we came on the air that testing delays can be up to 7 to 10 days or even longer. So that makes it really challenging to look at the daily number of new case reports and really know what's happening. That's like what you were just suggesting. Ideally, we would want to know how many new cases are there every day. But those numbers always end up getting backfilled. So however many are reported today, often you'll see more cases added later on, retrospectively saying, actually, on this particular day, there were more cases than we originally thought. Another thing that people have been tracking a lot is deaths. And that's informative because, you know, obviously that's the most extreme and severe thing that we want to be avoiding as a society. But it's also sort of a flawed indicator because deaths lag far behind cases. So the people that are dying of COVID today got infected probably 3 to 4 weeks ago. And so that reflects what conditions were like 3 to 4 weeks ago. So the people who are getting infected today, we won't see that effect on deaths for several weeks going forward into the future. So the ideal types of numbers to look for are trajectory, or these numbers that tell us something about the growth rate of the pathogen. By now, you've probably heard about the number R-naught, which is the number of the average number of new infections that each infected person causes. In the absence of information about that, another number that can be really useful is the proportion of tests that are positive, and especially if you track changes in that over time. So there's two things that that can tell us. One is, in general, you want the proportion of tests that are positive to be low because that implies that the majority of people who are infected are getting tested, and in fact, lots of people who aren't infected are still having access to tests. So that one thing about that that's useful is just knowing how good your testing coverage is. And then given that your testing coverage isn't changing too much from week to week, if you start to see changes in the proportion of tests that are positive, that's also an indicator that, like kind of an early indicator, that the epidemic is growing locally. So, for example, where I live in California, we've started to see an uptick in the proportion of tests that are positive recently, which is a really worrying sign for our public health department.
One of the biggest challenges you mentioned is that not everyone who has the virus is going to get tested and captured in the data totals. Is there any way to estimate how many people are infected but not tested to get a better idea of the true numbers of cases on any given day?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of where the science comes in epidemiology is, for example, in my lab, we're working on a model for epidemic dynamics of COVID, where we're trying to estimate the true number of people that are becoming infected on any given day as a function of the number of reported cases, which we know is only a fraction, as well as the number of reported deaths, which we also know is only a fraction, and the mobility data, which are based on cell phone, anonymized cell phone-based mobility data. So, you know, on a given day, how many cell phones are leaving their home versus staying home. So using those three types of data, we can try to estimate on any given day what's the transmission rate, and then how does that translate into the total number of infected people. But it's not a really simple, straightforward thing to do. It requires epidemiological models that really take a lot of expertise.
And I imagine a model like that would vary not just state by state, but city by city probably too.
It varies quite a bit. Not only kind of based on underlying factors in a given location, like the demography of a city, the social and racial inequities in a city, the types of jobs that people do, how mobile people are in a given location. All of those things sort of set the stage for what type of epidemic you might have, but then also people's behavior and how they're responding to the epidemic. So policy actions, both at the local and state and national level, and also individual level behaviors and decisions, like do you get together with friends? Do you wear masks? Do you tend to see other people outdoors versus indoors? All of those things have really important consequences for transmission.
I've seen a lot of people debating the death rate of this virus. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? And also, while there might be an overall death rate figured out at some point, it sounds like this, too, has a lot of variables.
Yes, you're exactly right. Especially early in the epidemic, people were talking a lot about the case fatality rate, which is, you know, for everyone with a case of COVID, or, you know, what proportion of those people end up dying. And one of the things that complicates that is how do you define a case? Is it based on people who had symptoms, based on people who had severe symptoms, based on the average across all people? One thing we know very clearly for this particular pathogen is that the rates of death are much higher in the older age groups than in the younger age groups. And the rates of death are also much higher, particularly in groups that have underlying health conditions, things like heart disease and diabetes and lung conditions. But by all means, people who don't have those conditions are also at risk of death. So exactly as you said, the individual level risk for a given person depends on their age and health condition, as well as a lot of factors that we don't understand yet, frankly, why certain people have more adverse reactions than others. And so you're absolutely right that there's not a single death rate. There's sort of an average death rate that can be calculated based on someone's age or demographic status or a population-wide demographic rate. So populations that tend to skew older will have a higher average death rate from COVID.
We're also seeing this phenomenon of death rates coming down while new cases are going up. What could that possibly be telling us?
Yeah, especially recently, we've started to see this phenomenon. And I think one of the major factors contributing to that is if you look at the age distribution of cases, we're starting to see more cases in younger adults during this current phase of the epidemic, like June and July. And younger adults tend to have a lower death rate from COVID. Now, why are we seeing more cases in younger adults than previously? I think there could be a variety of explanations for that. One is that older adults who know that they're in a high-risk group might be being much more careful, or they might be retired, so they might not be back at work and exposing themselves to other people, whereas younger adults may at this point be forced to go back to work, or they may have decided that they're over it and they're going to go to the bar and hang out with their friends. So those things could be at play. Another potentially slightly more encouraging idea that could be at play is that we also know that the severity of symptoms that people experience tends to increase with age. So early in the epidemic, when testing was really, really limited, only the most severely ill people were getting tested. And so most of the cases that were detected were in those older people who were experiencing really severe illness. Now that there's more widespread testing availability in many places, younger people who have been exposed are also being tested. And so we might be catching more of the mild cases than we would have previously. So there's kind of a few different ideas there.
Another thing I'm seeing people talk about a lot is herd immunity. Can you talk about that concept and whether this is something that's possible with COVID-19, given that we don't actually know yet for certain that people develop an immunity to this virus?
Yeah, this is a great question. Herd immunity is basically the concept that for any given disease, depending on how infectious it is, you need a certain fraction of the population to be susceptible to that disease in order for an outbreak to happen. So, for example, that's why you tend to have circulation of different strains of flu in different years, because after a strain of flu has circulated through a population, a lot of that population is immune, and so the flu can't really gain traction in that same population as long as that subpopulation remains immune. So herd immunity is the idea that once an epidemic has swept through a population, there aren't enough susceptible people left because most of the population is mounting an effective immune response, and so you don't get another epidemic for a while. The problem with herd immunity in this particular case is that, as for a lot of respiratory pathogens, the proportion of the population that has to get infected for a population to have herd immunity is really high. So it could be anywhere from 60 to 80% or more of a population. And that depends a lot on the pathogen and a lot on the setting. But we certainly don't want 60 or 80% of our population to get infected with COVID, because that would mean many, many, many deaths. And so some of the earliest models of COVID, some of the really well-respected models, like the one that came out of Imperial College back in March, suggested that if we just let the disease run rampant and spread through populations until we had herd immunity, we would see millions of deaths in the UK and in the US. So pretty quickly, it became clear that that was not going to be an effective strategy. There's a lot of nuance to this idea of herd immunity. But the other application of this idea is if and when we have a vaccine that makes people immune to the virus in a similar way to people who have been naturally infected with the virus, herd immunity determines what proportion of the population has to be inoculated with the vaccine to prevent a future epidemic. So it's an important concept, but I think it's been pretty clearly debunked, at least in the policy world, the idea that we should just let the virus spread until we have herd immunity. You brought up another really important point, which is we don't even know how long immunity lasts to SARS-CoV-2. There's examples of other coronaviruses where we think people have long-lasting immunity, like the SARS-CoV-1 virus that broke out in 2003. But then there's examples of other coronaviruses where immunity is short-lived. Things that tend to cause the common cold, your immunity doesn't last very long after that. So I think we're starting to be in the phase of the epidemic now where people have been infected long enough ago that we can start to go back to those previously infected people and track some of the markers in their immune system. But we still don't understand very well exactly what is regulating the immune response and how much it's dependent on antibodies versus T cells, for example. So immunology is a very complex field, and we still don't understand enough about what makes people, what kind of drives people's immune response to SARS-CoV-2.
What about mutations? Is there any potential for this virus to mutate the way the flu virus does?
That's a great question, too. All viruses and all organisms on Earth in general, when they replicate, there's some level of error. So in their genetic code, not every single nucleotide is going to get replicated perfectly. So there's always some level of mutation. Some viruses have mechanisms for proofreading during replication, which coronavirus does, and that tends to reduce the rate of mutations occurring. So inevitably, the virus will evolve over time, just if nothing else, through random chance. We don't yet know how much it's going to evolve over the course of this pandemic, but at least preliminary evidence doesn't suggest that it's evolving really, really rapidly in the same way that flu can, for example.
That was Erin Mordecai, an assistant professor of biology at Stanford University, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. We did ask Mordecai about COVID-19 testing and a potential vaccine, but she says those are not her areas of expertise. Tomorrow, however, we will speak with Mordecai about schools reopening and the disproportionate impact this pandemic has had on people of color. That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.